She managed her brand, fair play.
A normal person from Wakefield, a remarkable artist, but a remarkable woman.
Hepworth was odd because she didn't see herself as a feminist at all and didn't see herself as, you know, I'm a pioneering woman. She just felt she was a pioneering sculptor.
I was born with the ideas of certain shapes in my mind. At least I remember as far back as 7. And the whole time one's been working at it and working, trying to simplify and make more mature, get the right scale and develop it according to the development of society.
Hello and welcome to Sculpting Lives, a podcast by me, Jo Baring.
And me, Sarah Turner. So Jo, this is our first podcast, an episode. Why are we doing this?
So we met in our professional lives. You are Deputy Director of the Paul Mellon Centre and I am Director of the Ingram Collection. We have a shared interest in art, but we realised when we met that we are really fascinated by sculpture in particular. And also during the course of our discussions, we realised that women artists and women sculptors in general are less commercially successful than men, less represented in national institutions, museums, possibly have less gallery shows. And we really wanted to unpick why that happens.
Absolutely. The situation is changing and we're noticing more exhibitions on women artists generally. But I think, you know, being a sculptor is a really difficult profession and professional choice. And then being a woman sculptor and kind of pursuing a career is really challenging. So in these episodes, we're looking at the lives and careers of different artists from the 20th and through to the 21st century to see how those women overcame challenges, faced barriers, and negotiated all these issues. I mean, sculpture is kind of notoriously difficult because it requires often quite a big studio space.
It's expensive to make.
It's
the fabrication.
Really expensive.
Traditionally male materials. You know, so one of the women artists that we talked about that we went to her studio said that when she was at art school, there was even a sign on the door saying, no ladies in the welding room. So if you're not even allowed to learn how to handle these materials, how do you pursue a career?
That's right. So sculpture was seen very much as a man's world, particularly in the 20th century. And I think just seeing how those women really overcame those assumptions about what a woman artist should be doing is a really fascinating subject. Mm. So who are we going to be looking at in this
podcast?
So
we've picked six women artists. So going from the 20th century to three living artists, we've chosen artists whose work was abstract, whose work was figurative. We've also picked women artists who had very different career arcs, so different reputations, different museum success, commercial success. And what we really want to do is get behind the story, so to really unpick what was actually going on. And to do that, we've been on tour, haven't we, Sarah?
We've
been around the country.
We've had great fun.
Yeah,
on
we've had
trains.
A great time. On the sleeper down to St. Ives.
Yeah.
So our first subject, Dame Barbara Hepworth.
Yeah, so we're going to start in Wakefield in West Yorkshire, where Hepworth was born in 1903. Yeah. So really we're starting at the beginning of the 20th century. Arguably, I think she's probably the best known woman artist in Britain in the 20th century and had
Absolutely.
An international career as well.
And you could tell from her voice was just at the end of that sound collage. I mean, she sounds like the Queen, doesn't she?
Incredibly
so
posh.
She belongs to a different she belongs to a totally different century. But also what was interesting was that in one of the obituaries about her when she died, it said the Queen of British Art is dead.
Yeah.
So how do you get from being a young girl born in Wakefield 1903 to being the Queen of British Art?
Absolutely. And I think although there's been quite a lot written about Hepworth and she's had some major shows in national galleries and museums, there's still a lot to find out about her. I think there's a sort of mystique or some assumptions as well about her and how she forged her career as a sculptor. So in a way, what we want to do in this episode is challenge some of those ideas and go to the places in which she made her work, go to her studios, talk to people who've worked really closely with Hepworth over the years and see if we can kind of find out more about her. So we began in Wakefield, where she was born, at a museum that's actually named after her, the Hepworth, and we talked to curator Eleanor Clayton about how Hepworth negotiated some of the challenges about being a woman sculptor.
One of the key themes of our podcast series is thinking about the relationship between gender and sculpture. And it's an interesting question with Hepworth, because it seems in some of the written texts that she put out there, she kind of resists being called a woman sculptor and closes down discussions about her gender. And is that something that you come across quite a lot in your research and in your work on Hepworth?
I think it's such an interesting question. And the answer is that she changes her mind over her life. And so have I. So I completely understand.
Interesting, right.
But, you know, so certainly, yeah, in the 40s, she absolutely rails against this. And she says things like, you know, art is not biological. You know, one can't be considered in that way. It's about form, etc., etc. Even after, for example, she's made work like Mother and Child, when she's been pregnant or just after giving birth. So you sort of think that there must be some sort of sensitivity, but she's very much no. But then later on, in the sort of early 70s, there are interviews where she talks much more explicitly about the experience of being a female sculptor. And I also think that when you think about how much she managed to make work in that period, in the 30s and 40s, it really is astonishing because, you know, Henry Moore had children, had a child as well. But
And a wife.
But a full-time carer for the child. Yeah. And the thought that you would be, even if you do have help, even if you have childcare, the thought that you're still the sort of primary carer of your
children.
Well,
it's just having the headspace, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. And the thing is that I think there's a kind of retrospective judgment. Like, I think in the 50s, there was a lot of judgment. The idea of having a nanny for your children in some circles was seen as really awful. And, you know, this is the time when, obviously, there's all this sort of psychoanalytic research being done about attachment and things like this.
Yeah.
So I do think there was a lot of judgment on Hepworth. I think there was a lot of judgment in Wakefield at the time about her being divorced as well.
Yeah, it would have been controversial.
It was quite controversial. Mm. But I think that what she does write about, though, is how, despite having childcare, like a nanny, she would be working and the children would interrupt her. And she mentions this in sort of various things, and she mentions it in a really positive way. So she says that she talks about her working day in things like Sunday magazines and things like that. And she says she'll work for a certain period and then she'll be disrupted by one of the children, or she'll have to do some cooking and then she'll go back to doing work. And she will always have some readings and some music in every day. And she said that she doesn't mind the disruptions. It's just sort of as long as she goes back to kind of finish the thought, and that's how she manages to work.
Right.
And I think that that's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it's quite inspirational.
To be able to hold on to that thread.
But she talks about it as if actually all of these things that she's doing is part of the work.
Yeah.
You know, so even the interruptions is part of the work, because her work is expressing her kind of existence and her connection to everything around her. And, you know, so much of her work is about, you know, so she says, two forms, the relationship of one tender living thing to another. So, you know, these interactions with her children or doing cooking or whatever, it's all part of the creative process.
Yeah.
And I do think it's incredibly inspirational. Mm. And I think that maybe it's one of the reasons why her work is so rich and relatable and related to life, in the way that perhaps an artist who is working in the studio away from that doesn't necessarily have all those connections.
So let's catch up on her biography a bit. She went to school in Wakefield, she went to Wakefield Girls High School, and after that she went to Leeds College of Art, where, amazingly, another great titan of modern British sculpture was studying there, Henry Moore.
Yep, they were friends throughout their life and career, although it does seem that Henry Moore often got more attention. There's perhaps more literature written about him. He had more exhibitions.
He seemed to get more official support, like from the Arts Council, more international exhibitions, and that must have irritated her.
I think it did. Yeah, so when she's at the Royal College of Art, she's making friends and connections and has this ambition right from the very start that she's going to be an artist. She also marries a fellow artist, John Skeeping, and together they went to Italy and travelled around there and went to Florence, saw the great Renaissance.
And it was there that she really formulated her ideas about carving. So at this point in time, she's very much a carver. She calls herself a carver. Mm. And she learnt those skills, didn't she, there in Italy and brought them back to London.
Absolutely. And then she's in Hampstead, in North London, living and working amongst really avant-garde artists who are members of groups like Unit One, the 7 and 5 Society, the London Group, and are all really committed to an idea about a new British modern art.
That's right. And in her personal life, so as I said, she married John Skeeping, they had a son together. And then in the 1930s, that relationship starts to fall apart. She meets within her group of avant-garde artists and another artist called Ben Nicholson, and they begin a relationship. They have triplets together, which I can't even begin to imagine what that must have been like. While they were not yet married.
No, so quite unconventional for that period. Getting divorced, starting a new relationship. And I think that's, something, again, that she had to negotiate.
That's right. Together with Nicholson, they moved down to St. Ives at the outbreak of the Second World War, alongside other modernist avant-garde artists like Nam Garbo. St. Ives has become mythic in the story of 20th century British art. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's this place, this town, a fishing village, essentially, on the edge of the British Isles, in West Cornwall, facing the high seas. But it wasn't somewhere that was remote and isolated, to be honest. It had been an artist colony since the late 19th century. And so it was well known amongst artists. I mean, it has this amazing light because it's surrounded by the sea. And it was a safe haven away from the bombings in London. But it did have that established cultural community in which Hepworth could work and be amongst other artists.
She actually lived and worked in St. Ives until her death in 1975. And in addition to the museum, the Hepworth Wakefield, which is named after her, there's also her studio and gardens, which became a museum quite soon after her death, and which is run by the Tate. So we went down there to talk to the curators there to find out a little bit more about Hepworth.
In the spaces of Hepworth's studio and gardens, we spoke to Sarah Matson, curator at Tate St Ives.
Can you tell us where we're standing now?
So we are in Hepworth's, living area. She moved in to Trewin Studio, which is what this studio's, what these buildings and this garden is called. And she moved in, and this was initially her working space. She moved in 1949, and it was initially her working space. She had a house with Ben Nicholson, the painter, in Carbis Bay.
Right.
And in 1949, he got one of the beautiful Porthmere studios. And she managed to acquire this building and the garden that was being sold off from the big Trewin estate. It was the summer houses and work sheds, etc., and supported with some financial donations from friends and loans and a little bit of her own money. She was able to purchase the space. And this room, which you actually accessed via a ladder up through the up through the floor there, which she later had the staircase put in, was initially a carving studio. And I think she did wood carving in here. But gradually, as her marriage to Ben Nicholson dissolved and they sort of moved apart, she moved in. And it was for a while a hybrid working space and then largely her living space. A selection of her sort of key works, her key carvings, that give you a sense of, her back catalogue from, one of the earliest works is Infant, which is a 1928 carving when she was making figurative forms following her return from Italy and carving in wood, in African dark wood, right the way through to this really important work called Single Form September, which was one of a group of works that relate to the United Nations single form that sits in the United Nations Plaza. So now we're out in the garden, and of course we see this incredible, I have to say I'm a little bit smug about the garden, because over the last 4 or 5 years we've worked really hard with our gardener to sort of curate the plants, bring back the original design, and highlight the structure of the garden in relation to the plantings and, you know, sort of how it was in the 70s. So you get this sense of that opening moment of the museum, but still with the sense of how Hepworth had it at that time.
Was she interested in the garden?
Oh,
it
my goodness.
It wasn't just a workplace. It was,
no.
This was kind of important to her.
It was so important to her because in the, I mean, she moved in 1949 and it had some mature plantings, you know, from the estate house. She had a very close friend called Prio Reynier, who was the South African composer. And the pair of them had, you know, a conceptual, strong friendship that enabled them to have this dialogue around the garden. Hepworth had become really interested in planting. She loved roses. There's lovely letters in the collection that talk from her father suggesting roses that she might have. But the pair of them designed the garden in relation to her sort of sculptural output, which then the plantings very much respond to her. The nature of her forms, and she was very careful to place her works, which were often placed on breeze blocks sort of throughout the garden, you know, in particular concert with one another.
Because I guess she'd think, you know, they'd move on. She'd hope that they'd
absolutely
either in commissions or she would sell them, that this would be
absolutely
a temporary home for them.
Yeah. Well, by 1976, I mean, you know, she had various, she always kept an edition of her bronzes.
Right.
So, you know, the garden was very full, and, you know, it had lost its, you know, initial design. But of course, you know, she didn't start making or working in bronze until 1956, when she sort of found a way to articulate her, you know, conceptual thinking around direct carving into a process that would enable her to work in bronze. She never wanted to model.
Because she saw herself as a carver.
She saw herself as a carver. I think, you know, one of the things I'm really interested in, and, you know, again, these new, you know, perspectives on her work enable us to draw out ideas of, you know, the sort of performance of carving and the memory of the body in terms of experience and, you know, sort of imposing a kind of image, a conceptual image onto a work. You know, as you sort of come to looking at the bronzes, you know, there's no material to start with. You know, she articulates the aluminium armatures and plasters the material substance onto those.
To build them up.
They're very constructivist.
She'd been used to taking form away as a
exactly.
carver.
But that's the start of it. And then then that went very hard. And then she could carve the hard plaster. She did like a hard challenge. She could carve it back. Mm. So, you know, there was a way that she could bring the process of carving and the mark of the artist back into the bronze, and then it would be translated from the plaster prototype into the bronze form. Mm. And then, of course, again, you know, that relationship between surface and patina and the form itself could then be unfolded, you know, as the work was made.
Do you think she's also thinking about other issues when it comes to starting to work in bronze? For example, being able to make large-scale public commissions?
Yes, absolutely.
And maybe under pressure from dealers to do additioned works?
All the above, yes. I mean, I think, you know, I read a quote recently where she sort of talks about the art circus, you know, and the fact that, you know, she is being sort of pressured into bronze. I mean, you know, by comparison, I think Moore found that quite, you know, quite an easy transition, whereas she took a while to think about what it meant to have a practice in bronze, which she'd been rejecting, you know, early on in her career when she had her formative ideas around carving and made the statement, you know, I am a modern artist, you know, I'm a modernist, and, you know, I'm defined by the fact that I carve. You know, by the late 50s, having to sort of not revoke that, but find a way of working in bronze that would allow her to take on these big commissions, allow her to tour her works. Of course, you know, working in stone and in wood, they are inherently, you know, fragile
and heavy and shipping
difficult.
Costs and things.
Also, you know, and the British Council were making tours, and, you know, she needed to be represented in that.
From the Hepworth Museum and Garden, Sarah took us across the road to a building which is known as the Palais de Danse, and that actually hints at its past. It was a dance studio. Hepworth took it on because it enabled her to facilitate and to make large-scale, public, monumental sculptures. Sarah, in our interview with her, talks about these pieces, You can actually see them, see images of them on our Sculpting Lives Instagram page, at Sculpting Lives. You may even already know some of them. They're on the side of the John Lewis Building in Oxford Street, the United Nations Plaza in New York. What did you find particularly interesting about this, Sarah?
Well, we talked before about the challenges of fabricating sculpture, especially large-scale bronze sculpture. You can't do this in a small studio with lots of stairs. Hepworth needed kind of semi-industrial spaces to make some of these monumental works. So she had to find a place in the small streets of St Ives where she could make big sculptures and get them out to the rest of the world.
We're looking at single form, and this is the outline of her plaster prototype for the UN commission that she made, largely through the death of Dag Hammarskjöld. She was invited to make a commission in his memory, and of course single form now stands on the UN plaza. I think it's something like 6.4 meters.
So we've come across the road, haven't we, from the garden studio to the Palais de Dance.
Yes, and this was the studios that she acquired by 1961.
So you're opening up two large gates out onto another yard.
It's quite a big space, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can see there's an image of winged figure standing here,
looking
enormous.
And this really gives you a sense of the scale of her production.
Yes, absolutely.
She needs these kind of quite industrial spaces in many ways to manufacture and...
It's amazing that she constructed this in the tiny streets of St Ives. And even now, when we're walking around this morning, we commented on people's big 4x4s were having trouble negotiating it. So I mean, how on earth she got these out?
You know, a major event of the summer is somebody getting their Audi Quattro stuck in the Daiji. That's a fact. And, you know, the streets, they again had all sorts of mechanisms and a huge number of people involved in getting her work out.
I suppose there's a lot of local goodwill.
Yes, and, you know, people... I mean, even today, of course, if we move or shift any of the sculptures, we work with a local mover who knows exactly the adverse camber of every cobbled street and the ability to get, you know, the flatbeds or the air ride trucks or whatever we use around certain corners, you know. And you have to be really careful, particularly with air ride, because they're so wobbly that, you know, you can find people crushed against the wall if you're not, you know, it's all of these kind of logistics.
Yeah. Sculpture's dangerous.
Taking out an unwary tourist.
You know, so as her work got bigger, it became more, you know, more of an issue to move it. She sort of created a kind of viewing area. And the height of Four Square Walkthrough is directly correspondent with this, the height of this room. So, you know, she used the, you know, spaces she had to the max. And the height of Meridian was completely the same height as the space that she had in the rooms that she could find on Four Street. So, you know, she would use the expansion of space that she could, you know, to its fullest extent.
Yeah, and that kind of speaks to how important studios are.
Yes.
And if you don't have one, it limits the kind of work that you can actually produce.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, you know, it's difficult for sculptors, isn't it? Particularly if they're working directly with their materials, about finding space these days to work.
In that large studio, the Palais de Dance, Hepworth was really making bronze sculptures. So let's go back to that transition to bronze in the 50s, because that's obviously of huge significance to her career, her reputation, how visible she was internationally. But that move to bronze happened quite late in her career, didn't it, in the mid-50s?
I think the context is important. Working after the Second World War, when there's a lot more commissions from the government, from local councils, from
schools.
Yeah,
it's kind of unprecedented public commissioning.
And people want sculpture that can be outside in the public realm. And Hep was very conscious of this. And I think bronze allows her to experiment with her sculptural language, but also respond to the physical and logistical challenges of making sculpture for outdoor spaces.
In order to be visible, in order for her reputation to increase and take advantage of those public commissions, she had to work in bronze, didn't she? So she was aware of that.
And it's more commercial, of course, because you can make many additions.
You can make an addition of 4 or 5 and those can be sold as well. So not only is she thinking artistically, she is thinking commercially. She's thinking about her reputation. And that is something we picked up on with Stephen Feek, who is a former curator at the Henry Moore Institute and curator at the New Arts Centre.
I think she's very conscious of her role and making sure that she was part of something. Mm-hmm. And I think the move into bronze is very key for that, because I think that does open up a whole different way of working, but also opens up the big public commissions. I mean, there'd been a few, but it'd always been carving. But the idea of moving into bronze and, you know, in a way, the sort of climax of that is things like the UN, you know, does take her to a different level. She did push herself and was a very good salesperson of her own work, and I think did also, quite amazingly, have a contract with, when she moved to the Marlborough Gallery, she managed to have a contract with them where they paid her production costs, which was sort of unheard of. Which I think to sort of lessen the burden of, you know, that outlay, you know, carving was expensive enough, but casting was a sort of another level. So I think that really, I think in the back of her mind was this sort of, I mean, not poverty as such, but, you know, financial concerns that she had, because you've still got a career that you're trying to build up, you've still got to live. You've got to find the space, and then when you start having assistance, you know, you are employing
you're paying people, their wages.
You're paying their wages, and you're trying to support your family. Yeah.
So how important do you think that kind of commercial acumen is in terms of an artist's reputation and career?
I think it's the sort of weirdness of the art world, in fact, that, you know, it's all very nice, but actually underneath it all is this sort of beating heart of commercial pressure. Mm.
So what we can hear there from Stephen is that Hepworth was very active in what you call the hustle, Joe, of the art world.
That's right. So I actually come from a commercial background rather than your more lofty academic background in terms of the art world. I think, you know, we're all aware of the current international art market, you know, Damien Hirst, Diamond Encrusted Skull and all that kind of thing. We think that is quite a recent thing. But actually, you know, when we spoke to Eleanor Clayton at the Hepworth Wakefield, you know, she's saying back in the 1940s, Hepworth is hustling. You know, she's writing to dealers, she's writing to buyers, potential buyers. But what I also find fascinating is that Hepworth was aware of the importance of having her work in institutions and what she did herself to make that happen.
She's so active in her promotion.
Is she?
Yes. She's very active with her in writing to her dealers, her various dealers. She's very active in writing to people that she thinks she
might
like
to buy
to be her
works.
Dealers.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely, to people who she wants to buy works.
The British Council.
The British Council. With Wakefield Art Gallery directors, she you know, wrote to them all the time. She was constantly sort of hustling on their behalf, so kind of saying, you know, one of the works that we have... that we acquired, the first work that we acquired in 1941, I'm just taking credit, was Pierced Hemisphere. Yeah. And that was a work that she initially wrote to the director of the art gallery saying it was acquired by an early collector and he's willing to sell it to you at a discounted rate of what he paid for it, because she had basically said how important it would... So she'd spoken to the collector, said how important it would be for her to have a significant work in the gallery of her hometown. He had agreed to sell it for this price. The director couldn't afford it, said we can't afford it, so she arranged for her father to buy it and give it to the museum. So she was kind of really...
She realised the importance of placing her work in institutions.
Absolutely, yeah. And she kept in touch with people like this really, really well. So, you know, this is why it's sort of frustrating to then see the sense that her being talked about as being a difficult person or whatever, because actually she did her business really well, you know, but she just didn't necessarily have the sort of personal... soft skills.
But she was successful. She was successful in ensuring that her work made it into institutions.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's probably the best known woman artist,
that's right,
say, of the 20th century in Britain.
Absolutely.
Yeah, without a doubt.
But, you know, I guess the thing to say is that she worked hard at it.
She did,
Not just in making the work, but in making that career happen.
Yeah, I think
that
commercial aspect is crucial.
What is interesting with her is this tireless dedication to being an artist.
Yes.
And you get the sense she never gives up on that idea that she is going to be an artist and that is what she is going to be and only will be. And I think that kind of, that tenacity that she shows throughout her life is quite phenomenal.
It's testament to the success.
And I'm interested in what you said about the dealer. So if she's got a dealer, but she's always looking to the next dealer who might be able to present her on a different stage.
Well, she was actually very dedicated to Gunpow Feast, mm-hmm. but it was more thinking about, you know, they looked after her in the UK, so she was courting dealers in America. So she was trying to get dealers who were representing Nicholson and Moore to represent her. And when they didn't, was trying to then look to other dealers who might, you know, so that was kind of... and when she did have a dealer, she was writing to them a lot, saying, you know, when's my next show going to be? You know, I'm making this stuff, you know, so constantly keeping up to date and kind of pushing them to promote her.
Yeah, the world doesn't come to you, does it? You have you have to get out there.
And I think that's good advice for everyone.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Hepworth was already thinking during her lifetime about turning her studio and garden into a museum.
That's right. So not only in her lifetime is she thinking about her reputation and her position in the art world as it stands, she's also thinking about what it's going to be like when she dies, which I find fascinating. She enlists the help of her family, doesn't she? But there's a particularly crucial family member that's involved.
Yeah, and that's her son-in-law, isn't it?
Alan Bowness, who is also the director of the Tate.
She died in this room in 1975. And as the year after, very quickly, the estate, who responded to a request in her will to perhaps turn this studio into a museum, if the public would like that, was acted upon. And the museum was opened in April 76, very quickly. And obviously they, with the help of Norman Reed, Alan Bowness, Hepworth's son-in-law, and also soon to be director of the Tate for a period of time, worked with Sarah, his wife, and Hepworth's daughter, to represent both a selection of works that would give a sense of the array of different forms that Hepworth and materials that Hepworth used across her career, so some key works. And she was very aware of that. She was buying back works towards the end of her life, you know, in the 60s and 70s, because she felt that she needed to create an archive. And I'm sure that this was very much at the forefront of her mind.
Not many artists have galleries and museums named after them. So I think it's significant that Hepworth has two, in fact. And so we talked to Eleanor Clayton about how the Hepworth Wakefield came about.
Well, Wakefield Art Gallery has been going since 1934, and Wakefield had this incredibly progressive collecting policy where it was established with this idea that they would collect modern art. Well, what they said was that they wanted to keep in touch with modern life in its relation to modern art. So this idea that art reflects our contemporary experience, or that we can learn something from our contemporary experience through the art that's being made. And so they started building this collection at this time when obviously local artists, Hepworth and Moore, were gaining kind of prominence on the international and national field of sculpture. So they collected their work early. So we have great works by Hepworth in the collection. The first work was acquired in 1941, and she had some of her earliest public shows here. And then over time, the old Wakefield Art Gallery, was felt that they needed a new space because it was in an old townhouse. It was in sort of great need of repair, but also all the necessary accoutrements of a modern museum, like a cafe and sort of learning studios, you know, space for engagement. And so the idea of a new museum was mooted, but this was really sort of pushed along by the offer of the Hepworth family gift. So the Hepworth family offered a significant number of Hepworth's plaster prototypes and other material to do with her working processes, but particularly these 44 plaster sculptures that she worked on and that were used as the basis of her bronze casts from the late 50s onwards. So this opportunity Wakefield Council sort of seized upon, and the idea was that it would be called the Hepworth Wakefield, partly to sort of celebrate this gift, which is on permanent display, so you can always get a sense of Hepworth's practice here, but also to really connect Wakefield to Hepworth, because she's known, had, or at that time certainly was known or associated more with St Ives, where she lived for the second half of her life. But actually she always talked about the prominence of Yorkshire and Wakefield and the surrounding landscape
in her sort of early artistic inspiration. And, you know, famously and much quoted, said something like, you know, I think what one wants to say is formed in childhood and one spends the rest of one's life trying to say it.
Can we talk about the gallery itself?
Yes.
Because we're walking through these incredible interconnected rooms, and as you mentioned earlier, this was purpose-built when by the architect David Chipperfield, and it feels quite sculptural, and there's something about these block rooms with really interesting angles. Is there a relationship to Hepworth's work in the form itself?
100%. David Chipperfield was really inspired by Hepworth's sculpture, and he designed the rooms with their sort of geometry, as you say, exactly based on this idea. And then the other thing that he was inspired by with Hepworth was this idea of connecting to the landscape and to our environment. So almost all of the gallery spaces have windows that look out on significant landmarks around us. So one window looks out on Wakefield Cathedral, another window looks out on Emily Moore, another one looks out on the Chantry Chapel. So he sort of orientated these series of interconnecting kind of abstract cubes, essentially, so that they had particular connections out to the landscape.
So we left the Hepworth Wakefield and went down the road to the Yorkshire Sculpture Park, where Hepworth is one of the most important artists that's on display there. There is a piece called Family of Man, which Sarah and I spent quite a lot of time walking around, didn't we?
Yeah, Yorkshire Sculpture Park is one of my favourite places in the whole wide world. And on the recording, you can hear other visitors chatting away and also the background hum of a sit-on mower. The perils of recording outside.
Exactly. Yeah. We also spoke to Claire Lilly, who's the director of programming at the park, to really find out why Hepworth's work has such a resonance to her visitors and why it's so important. So we're standing in front of one of Hepworth's most famous late sculptural pieces, aren't we? Which is Family of Man.
Yeah, made in 1970. Bronze sculpture of many parts. These totemic standing figures, which are sited here at the Yorkshire Sculpture Park.
Going down a hillside,
aren't they? Sloping hillside. And it's kind of wonderful how the trees that are also here seem to become part of this sculptural installation.
Yeah, exactly. And what's really interesting is that it says, so we're just looking here, and it says that Hepworth was so keen for the work to be experienced outside, and that when she's thinking about the work, she's actually thinking about them in a landscape. And I can't help but think, when looking at them now, this is exactly how they're supposed to be sited. Yeah. And this is a loan from the estate, isn't it? So this has been a long-term loan.
It's been here as long as I can remember, and I've been visiting with my family for a long time. It's interesting Hepworth saying that she wanted her sculptures to breathe, and by being outside, it's almost like the space in between the parts of this sculpture are just as important as the objects themselves. There's this kind of strange force field in between the sculptures. It feels to me like they're talking to one another, and there's a sort of a resonance between each object.
I think that piece in particular, for a number of reasons, it's complete, it's the complete body, and it's the only place in the world now that you can see it. And I think for us it's really important that people do feel an emotional connection to this place, and the idea of the Family of Man in its kind of literal sense is really, and metaphoric sense, is really important, that people feel that they're connected to this place, that they feel welcome, and that there is a kind of a tolerance and an understanding and an exchange, a kind of communion, really, that goes on here. And it does go on here. I mean, it's really difficult to articulate.
Yeah, but it's very personal.
It's really personal, but we've all seen it. And we've seen people in tears, and we've seen people elated.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a very particular experience here.
Claire Lilly spoke there about the emotional response that people continue to have with Hepworth's work, and especially when it's cited in the landscape. There's something, I think, very particular about sculpture, where you're made very aware about your own body in relationship to the form of the sculptural work.
That's right. And also something particular about Hepworth's work is her own relationship to landscape, and how
the natural forms in landscape were extremely inspiring to her. And that's something that Sarah Mattson at Tates and Ives also picked up on.
People will always relate to sculpture in a way that's very meaningful, because you're operating in the same space as it, and there's a dialogue on even terms with it that allows us to commune, if you like, in a way that perhaps other media, maybe I'm biased, I don't know, but other media don't allow you to do.
Both nodding.
Yeah, we agree.
But, I'm preaching to converted, aren't I?
We're
signed
up.
Yeah.
We're at the top of the garden, we're just looking around this, but there's still so many more people coming in. And also, when we arrived, there were children jumping in and out of the sculpture and sitting on it.
Her late work, Conversation with Magic Stones, this work's extraordinary because it brings together so many of those aspects of her work. It's like a compendium of her work, because it brings together ideas around abstraction, the pagan landscape, because they're like standing stones, the relationship to that landscape, but also, this sense of being able to actually stand within it. Mm. And it, again, allows you to be on equal terms with it. And what Hepworth understood, all through her career, she understood and wanted to convey the positive relationship, the power of human relationships, and the positivity of human relationships. She was very aware that, Menhirs and Coits and, places like Stonehenge had, a very significant ritual purpose that brought people together.
Yeah.
So this kind of social purpose of the single form or the multiple form together was really significant to her work.
And the name's really interesting. Obviously, conversation, one thing, that there's a dialogue, but also this idea of magic. And she does seem to be, especially, I think, after her move to Cornwall, increasingly interested in ideas about magic, mysticism.
Yeah.
She talks a lot about the spirituality of art as well.
Yes, yeah.
And that seems to be something that grows throughout her, particularly her later life.
I think, certainly. I mean, she talks about a moment of praise. I can't recall the quote particularly, but making sculpture is like a moment of praise. But her spirituality and her interest in mysticism, she never pins her flag to any particular mast.
Yeah.
So one of the things we're trying to do in this podcast is really get behind the accepted story of an artist, and especially the story of Barbara Hepworth. She's a dame. She's almost like a national treasure, isn't she?
Do you think her work is seen as quite safe now?
I think so. I think people are so used to it. And it's so easy to de-radicalise her, to forget that she was this very important, radical, avant-garde artist.
What's really struck me as we've been travelling around and talking to these curators and people who work with Hepworth's artworks is why she's still relevant now. And they've all spoken about that, the way that visitors to their galleries are still really powerfully moved by her work. And there's a sense that there's still research and new things to say about her career and why she made such an impact, not only on British art, but
internationally as well. Yeah. And that's something that Eleanor Clayton at Hepworth Wakefield spoke quite clearly about.
In terms of her politics, I mean, I think that's interesting to think about her as a political sculptor as well. Again, that might have been suppressed in the histories of her work, but her active involvement with kind of anti-nuclear
CND,
on marches. And I think, again, that sort of thinking about her role, that she was very conscious of her role as a sculptor for the state as well, in that, especially in the post-war period, that believed that sculptors should be active, I think.
Well, I guess she had a moral responsibility, would you say? She felt an obligation to make work that engaged with those political issues, that she had a platform.
Absolutely, but this goes all the way back to the 30s as well. There are amazing letters between Hepworth and Mondrian on the cusp of the Second World War, talking about how, as artists, they had this responsibility to fight the Nazis, but through ideas, through their art. And I think that I feel like she's such a relevant artist still because of these really wide-ranging ideas, because of her interest in new technology, because of her involvement in politics, and because we are also in a time now where these ideas are really inspirational, when we can think about art, connecting people across nationalities, across boundaries. It's really important.
Obviously, the key theme of this podcast is gender, about being a woman and a woman sculptor. And it's something that we quizzed Stephen Feek about, and he was very interesting in his response.
Hepworth was odd because she didn't see herself as a feminist at all and didn't see herself as, you know, I'm a pioneering woman. She just felt she was a pioneering sculptor. And I think that's a very interesting... I mean, there's a lot of work to be done on that, how you can, on the one hand, be a pioneer but not consider yourself feminist.
And I think that does have a lot to do with the wider context of art history and art criticism, that feminist scholarship hadn't taken hold in Britain and wouldn't do so until the 70s and the 80s. And so, again, she is working ahead of that curve as well. So the people who are writing about her and her allies within the wider critical field aren't using a language of feminism and feminist scholarship. And so it's quite interesting to see the work that researchers are doing now, who have imbibed all that work. You know, we've sort of got a new way of thinking about women artists in social and political contexts, of why careers come to market and how people are written about. So I think that's quite interesting when that critical language is not there either, to see those things in tandem.
And I do think, I mean, sometimes it does come down to the individual's personality as well, because, I mean, by her own admission, she wasn't particularly easy, you know, didn't have, I mean, she was shy and quite reserved and really just wanted to sort of make work. And I think she was probably happier writing about her work than sort of having this kind of conversation about it.
And she did write a lot, didn't she?
A lot. And I think it's an interesting stage, really, because I think she was very good at self-mythologizing. And I think, on the one hand, that's great because you have something to refer back to. But it's funny how much that has coloured people's sort of reactions, especially now, to her. I mean, most texts on Hepworth start with quotes from Hepworth. And it's sort of, she's kind of created the mould in a way. And I think it's very difficult to sort of break out from that. But I think for her reputation to continue to grow, you sort of need to start distancing ourselves slightly from what she said. You know, it's still obviously very important. It's very important that an artist's reputation isn't just kept in aspic. I mean, I think it's extraordinary that until the Tate show a couple of years ago, that there hadn't been a big museum show in London since 1968. And yet she is the best known woman British sculptor.
There's a museum named after
her. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it just seemed extraordinary. You know, and I think there has to be a lot done to keep her reputation alive. That's both commercially, but also intellectually. And I think you can, in a way, be too controlling. You can kind of try and protect a reputation too much that doesn't allow reinterpretation and reappraisal. Because I think it's very important that they're not just stuck in a certain kind of rut, that you do allow sort of interesting aspects to come to the fore. And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, why Hepworth seems so exciting now, because there's so, you know, there's a lot been done, but it's amazing how much hasn't been done yet.
Hepworth left behind an incredible body of work, an incredible body of writings too, and there are two museums dedicated to her work. So it's just been amazing, actually, to travel around with you, Jo.
I know. And also what we found in our subsequent conversations with living artists, with women sculptors, is what an inspiration Hepworth continues to be for them. So in terms of her reputation and what she achieved in the 20th century, she continues to be a lodestar, really, doesn't she, for contemporary women sculptors today?
Absolutely. And in the subsequent interviews that we've recorded, a lot of these women talk about the legacy and inspiration of Hepworth. So join us for future episodes of Sculpting Lives.
That's right. Next time we'll be delving into the career of Dame Elizabeth Frink, a figurative sculptor. who achieved great success in her lifetime, but perhaps her reputation suffered quite academically.
Yeah, and it's definitely less well-known than Hepworth.
Yeah, exactly.
So we just want to end by saying thank you to our sponsors. Thank you to the Paul Mellon Centre for Studies in British Art for making this podcast happen. And thank you to all the contributors who shared their ideas and their time so generously with us.
Took us behind the scenes. As we said earlier in the podcast, if you want to see any of the images and sculptures that we refer to, go to our Instagram page, which is at Sculpting Lives. Thank you and goodbye.
Bye.
This podcast was written and presented by Sarah Victoria Turner and Joe Baring, produced by Claire Lynch, with research assistance from Isabel Mooney.